a very good possibility that France may find a bit more backbone as a result of the support that it's getting from the non-aligned contingent.
Most everyone here would oppose this war even if it were free.
We believe in human rights and that we must enforce human rights all over the world.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Facing strong opposition from dozens of nations, the United States has backed down from its demand that a new UN resolution must explicitly authorize military force if Iraq fails to cooperate with UN weapons inspectors. Instead, the United States is floating a compromise that would give inspectors a chance to test Baghdad's will to cooperate on the ground. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies who covers the UN. Phyllis, the 114-member non-alignment movement in the UN, which represents the majority of the 191 member states, met to discuss this issue of military action against Iraq. Can you tell us what was decided in that meeting?
This was an open meeting of the Security Council that was initiated by the non-aligned movement under the leadership of South Africa, who's the current chair of the non-aligned. The meeting was a demand of the non-aligned because there was great concern that the United States and Britain were orchestrating a discussion in the Council about the Iraq resolution, the authorization of force or not, that whole series of questions, in discussions that only involved the five permanent members of the Council, the U.S., the U.K., France, Britain, and France, Russia, and China. And all of the other members, the 10 other members of the Council and the 180 other members of the United Nations, were being excluded. So the non-aligned asked for an open meeting of the Council. That meeting began yesterday morning, continued through last night, and is continuing through Thursday. And there has been a very strong, quite unified sense, actually, in the speeches and in the debates, a great deal of unease about the U.S. effort, the what seems to be a U.S. commitment to going it alone if they do not get U.N. endorsement for going to war. Since that time, since the discussions began Wednesday morning, there has been a new set of concessions offered by the United States. They're being reported overnight in the wire services and a number of newspapers that are designed to somewhat soften the U.S. approach. The meeting itself will not take a decision. There's no resolution on the table. It's a it's an opportunity for countries not among the five permanent members to make their voices heard and to make their opinions known.
Well, open meeting notwithstanding, and the non-aligned movement weighing in the final analysis, when the vote comes up at the UN, it'll of course be the Security Council members, the five that you mentioned, the U.S., the U.K., France, Russia, and China, who will actually vote. So what does this really mean that they've weighed in? How much weight does it really carry?
Well, it doesn't carry very much weight, as we know, with the Bush administration. It carries a great deal of weight with other countries. For example, there's been a great deal of speculation about whether France would maintain its stance of criticizing the U.S. position and demanding that there be a two-part process in the Council rather than a single resolution, as the U.S. wanted, that would call on Iraq to do to let in inspectors on a entirely new basis and threaten the use of force if there is any future violation. France had said they were not prepared to accept that, and there was a great deal of unease about whether France would ultimately cave in to U.S. pressure. The presence of 50 countries yesterday and more today expressing similar opposition to the U.S. go-it-alone strategy gives France a certain kind of political cover, which is very important. So even if it doesn't have much weight for the United States, it does have an impact in how this how this crisis may emerge.
So in other words, this unease that you've articulated on the part of the non-aligned movement could have an impact on France's decision as to whether or not it will waffle or not in
Absolutely.
Terms of this.
Absolutely. There's a very good possibility that France may find a bit more backbone as a result of the support that it's getting from the non-aligned contingent.
So apparently the way that the protocol is at the UN, there's absolutely no formal recourse that these non-aligned, that the non-aligned movement could pursue if it opposes the U.S. Adopting this go-it-alone position.
Well, that's not completely true. There is a precedent at the United Nations that says that if the Security Council is deadlocked, if, for example, the French stand firm and the U.S. refuses to give in to the French position, and the Council remains at its current impasse, under those circumstances, the General Assembly, which is by far the most democratic organ of the United Nations, made up of every member state, all 191 countries that are members of the UN are in the Council, are in the General Assembly, they can, under that very limited circumstance, take up an issue that would ordinarily belong only to the Council. It's called the Uniting for Peace precedent. And it's a very specific, rather technical part of UN regulations. But it's not impossible that if this deadlock continues in the Council, if the impasse remains, the next step for the non-aligned under South African leadership could conceivably be an effort to make a finding that the Security Council is indeed deadlocked and that, therefore, the issue can legitimately be taken up by the General Assembly instead.
Well, even if the General Assembly takes the issue up, if the U.S. has said it, you know, it's just, you know, not going to regard the U.N. action and it's going to go it alone, are there any repercussions for it?
Well, there's certainly nothing that the, given the realities of power in the world, there's nothing that the United Nations can do to stop a unilateral U.S. action. There's certainly not going to be a military effort, for example, to stop the U.S., or even a serious political effort. But I think it does put the U.S. in a very difficult position for the Bush administration to say, we're going to go ahead despite the affirmative opposition of virtually the entire rest of the world. It seriously undermines the credibility of their claim. I think it's for that reason that they have made the concessions that they appear to have made overnight.
And what are those concessions?
The concessions are regarding both the structure and, to a small degree, the substance of the resolution. The structure, it appears the U.S. is willing to accept the French version, which is a two-part resolution rather than a single resolution. The first part of the resolution would call on Iraq to allow inspectors in under a new set of guidelines, a new set of regulations for the inspectors, and that would be about it. And if there was a violation in the future, the U.S. would be expected to come back to the Council and consult about what the consequences should be. The U.S. position earlier had been that they demanded a single resolution that would both set new standards for Iraq to comply with for the inspectors and threaten directly the use of force and military force in any future in reaction to any future violations. It wasn't clear that this is a substantive shift, but it is significant that they are accepting the formula outlined by the French on the structure. On the substance, the U.S. has agreed to back down from two of the most contentious new regulations they want to impose on Iraq, one having to do with soldiers that would be accompanying the inspectors having the right to clear roads or to use force inside Iraq to clear what they would determine to be a blockading or a blocking of any roads. That was taken off the agenda. So it's a small small point, but it's one that could be an indication that the U.S. is feeling the pressure of this international mobilization against their position. The second question was the U.S. withdrawing from their earlier demand that the five permanent members of the Council be allowed to send representatives as part of the inspection teams alongside the UNMOVIC inspectors. This was something that had been very strongly opposed by the UNMOVIC director, Hans Blix, along with France and Russia, who felt it would undermine the credibility of the inspections which were supposed to be carried out by the United Nations. So the fact that the U.S. is backing off of these two rather technical but still significant earlier demands is an indication that they're feeling the pressure.
So what is the final resolution now, given these new concessions that have just been made by the U.S. with regard to the use of force on the part of the U.S.?
There still is no formal resolution on the table. This is still all at the level of negotiations. But if the reports are accurate of what the U.S. is conceding, the final resolution that will be voted on potentially quite soon would call for a new set of requirements for Iraq. They would be quite rigorous requirements, including the presence of military forces from the U.S. and other member states to accompany the UN arms inspectors. They would include the demand that Iraq open up all of the areas, including the so-called 8 presidential sites, to immediate no-notice inspections, disregarding the earlier agreements that had been reached between Iraq and the United Nations. But there would be no reference to consequences of an Iraqi violation leading directly to a military strike. The understanding would be, perhaps not written, but an understanding among the 5 permanent members, that if there were to be further Iraqi violations in the future, the U.S. would have to come back to the Council for another discussion, another debate, before the use of force could be authorized. The implication would be that the United States would be agreeing not to use force on its own if there is such a violation, but instead to come back to the Council. The danger, of course, will be that the U.S. will interpret the resolution to say if there is a need for a military strike based on the first resolution, we will do it anyway, regardless of whether or not we have the approval of the Council. So there's certainly no guarantees that the new resolution is going to protect the legitimacy of the UN and help to stave off this war. But the fact that the U.S. is feeling enough pressure to make concessions is an important small step.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis. While the Bush administration is building up for war against Iraq, confronting a threat of peace from the Iraqi regime's actions, its history of aggression and its arsenal of terror have come under attack. WPFW in Washington has more in this report.
Do you think that with North Korea admitting to having nuclear weapons and a nuclear weapons program, does this expose the short-sightedness of our policy towards Iraq? Is it hypocritical now? Good morning, you're on 89.3.
Yeah, the American people are opposed to being a world imperial power. The American people are opposed to triumphalism, and the American people are for multilateralism. But I think the people around Bush, their intention is to go for full U.S. hegemony in the world, and I don't think that. I think the people who need to be stopped are Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and these guys, not Korea or Iraq.
Thank you. Good morning. You're on 89.3.
Yeah. Hi.
Hello.
It's of no consequence that Korea has nuclear weapons. It's of no consequence. They're trying to make it seem like a big deal. They knew it all along because you can't hide that kind of development. They just let the cat out of the bag now because they want to,
they're setting the stage, so to speak.
They want to set the stage and have more fear in people because they have already been tagged as being evil. So now they say, well, look, these evil guys have got it too. So that's all that is. Don't be fooled. You know, they knew it all along, and it's really of no consequence. Just like even if Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, they say it's of no consequence because we've got more than everybody else in the world put together. So what consequence is it? I mean, that's silly.
Well,
all the people who run around talking about they're scared of it are being silly.
Well, with that being said, though, who do you think poses the most dire threat to the United States, North Korea or Iraq or some other power that is in possession of nuclear weapons?
Actually, the fact of the matter is nobody poses a dire threat to us. Because don't forget, even with weapons, you have to have delivery systems. You have to have the whole infrastructure to conduct a modern war. And nobody else in the world has the infrastructure to conduct modern war against us. So that's all a bunch of stuff. The real threat to America, if you will, is the capitalist, right-wing fascists that are in charge of the country. That's the real threat.
Good morning. You're on 89.3.
Good morning. This is Jerome speaking.
Hello, Jerome.
How could we not know that North Korea did not have nuclear weapons?
Exactly.
How could we not know that? And another thing, yes. You got to remember now, the bully goes after always the weaker ones. If another country such as France that we weren't friendly with, or Britain we weren't friendly with, or Germany we weren't friendly with, had nuclear weapons, we'd be negotiating,
right,
not planning an attack.
Right.
This whole administration, since day one, has never, in my opinion, lived up to what Clinton tried to do and emphasize in the world, and that's peace.
Good morning, you're on 89.3.
I can't quite recall President Bush's Axis of Evil speech, and I'll stand corrected by anybody who recalls it better than I do, but I think he mentioned North Korea in that speech.
Well, of course, but...
Well, it's interesting to me now that people want to say, you're right, North Korea doesn't have oil, but he mentioned it in the speech. But everybody wanted to say, oh, we were only going into Iraq because of the oil. No, we were going into Iraq for the reason he said, and we're going into North Korea for the reason he said. And oil really doesn't have much to do with it. What has to do with it is what he said. They have weapons of mass destruction, which is not a family value. You know, how we cannot distinguish right from wrong in this situation. How we can't look to the isolationism that we tried to have before World War II when we tried to sit it out. How we can't learn those lessons of history is just amazing to me, but they're all there, and I guess we'll see them as time goes by.
I just want to ask you, though, if that is a justification, then shouldn't we be planning to go into North Korea right now as we are with Iraq? I mean, shouldn't we be about to pass a war resolution for North Korea as well? And other countries that, I mean, you know, Pakistan, all these countries have nuclear weapons. What makes them stand out? What makes them different? What makes them this axis of evil?
Well, the answer is we are going to have to take this. We cannot be able to do it. We're going to have to leave it to the people who are in charge of the military in terms of the order that we take it. But what is different is what happened on September 11, which once again people don't want to acknowledge. To sit and say that essentially a street gang, which is what Al-Qaeda is, they've got about all the capability of a D.C. street gang, can take airliners and destroy the World Trade Center. And for us to say a nation with nuclear power, I don't care what else they don't have at the moment, poses no threat to us, is just to put a set of blinders on and to hope that nothing bad will happen. Mentality, and it's just not going to work.
Okay, sir. Thank you for your call and your opinion. We're going to go to the next call. Good morning. You're on 89.3.
Okay, a couple things. We have weapons of mass destruction,
right?
And we've used them. We used them against Iraq in a terrible way.
Yes.
The sanction is a weapons of mass destruction. Lots of children die in there.
Yes.
Also, the Israelis have the nuclear bomb or nuclear, you know, they've been consistently taking land and culture and committing genocide on the Palestinian people. It's not just about who has nuclear weapons. It's about the agenda that we have. And, you know, if you want to draw a parallel, the gentleman wanted to draw a parallel to the Second World War, you know, we're kind of like Germany, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking over the world, and it's the hegemony thing, you know.
And whipping in people into a patriotic frenzy.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good people in the United States thinking that, oh, well, we've got to do the right thing here. We've got to defend ourselves, you know. You know, what happened on 2/11, that was a
9/11.
Retaliation, and I use that word very carefully.
Right.
You know, it's something, you know, with what we've done to those people over there through our support with Israel and the whole thing of what we've done with Iraq, and we supported the Shah of Iran, the whole history, the whole trail of these little petty little dictators you go around the world. You know, it's going to come back to us, and the world is very small now. We're connected together with the current day version of the printing press, which is the internet, and I think it's a great thing and it's a great tool.
Thank you so much for your call.
I appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you.
Bye bye.
Those were actually the comments on Pacifica Station WPFW this morning as the callers reacted to news that North Korea has nuclear weapons. It was hosted by WPFW programmer Katia Stitt. President Bush believes it's troubling and sobering news, according to his spokesman Scott McClellan. He said the president planned to bring up the issue in talks next week with China's president. McClellan said that Bush decided to address the issue through diplomatic channels. The argument against the USA's military response to a nuclear threat was also addressed at American University last night. Peter Zunick, professor of history and director of American University's Nuclear Studies Institute, reminded the 250 students attending the panel discussion that, according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the United States and the other nuclear powers are supposed to move towards nuclear disarmament.
It's important that the United States start to play a very different role in the world. So long as the United States' goal is to maintain the status quo and to increase American power, then countries are going to have reasons and motives for trying to develop nuclear weapons or other terrorist tactics. So long as the United States' goal is to maintain the status quo in a world in which, until recently at least, the richest 300 people had more wealth than the poorest 3 billion people, if our goal is to maintain that kind of world, then countries are going to develop nuclear weapons, they're going to use terrorism, they're going to find other means. Right now there's another threat, though, and that threat is to the world is not exactly Iraq, but there is a nuclear threat, and that's why the New York Times had an editorial saying that the United States was the nuclear rogue nation that's threatening the world. In that New York Times editorial on March 12th of this year, it began, "If another country were planning to develop a new nuclear weapon and contemplating preemptive strikes against a list of non-nuclear powers, Washington would rightly label that nation a dangerous rogue state." Go on to say that there is such a state, and that's the United States under the Bush administration. So there is a real serious nuclear threat now, but it's not coming from a nuclear rogue nation. Dan Ellsberg wrote some years ago that the United States has used nuclear weapons repeatedly in the world. We use nuclear weapons in the same way that a person holding a gun to somebody's head in order to rob him uses that gun in the robbery, even if the gun is not shot. The United States has used nuclear weapons in that way dozens of times over the past few decades in order to get our way in the world. So the key right now is for the United States to set an example, both in terms of stopping our own nuclear proliferation, but also helping resolve some of these conflicts. We know the United States' role has been less than exemplary in helping solve the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The United States has been less than exemplary in solving the conflict between the Indians and the Pakistanis. What did we do after September 11th? We dropped our sanctions against India and Pakistan that we put on those countries because of their nuclear testing and development of nuclear weapons. So the question is, really, for us, as many of us are Americans, what is the American responsibility? What is the American role? What can we do to make sure that our government begins to play a positive and constructive role rather than a role of terrorizing, throwing its weight around, and trying to become the most dominant power in history, militarily as well as every other way? So at 1941, Henry Luce said this is going to be the American century. Henry Wallace said, no, it's got to be the century of the common man. We still have to make that same determination for the 22nd century as well.
Peter Zunick, professor of history and director of American University's Nuclear Studies Institute, speaking at a panel discussion last evening. After the 1991 Gulf War, Iraq agreed to UN Resolution 687, which set up a United Nations Compensation Committee to receive and approve compensation claims against Iraq for damages incurred during their invasion of Kuwait. Since the Oil for Food program started in 1996, 30% of all revenue of Iraqi oil sales has gone towards paying these claims. CKUT producer Sameya Elabayara spoke with Michael Schneider, a partner in a Geneva-based international law firm, which has represented Iraq before the UN Compensation Commission.
The UNCC, the United Nations Compensation Commission, is there in a sort of a reparation regime after the Gulf War. And that alone is a most exceptional situation because If you look in the history of the 20th century, and especially since the creation of the United Nations, there was never ever before such a system of reparations. And as you know, there were many invasions in many parts of the world, but nowhere did any of the invading country have to pay any reparations. And it was only after the Gulf War that by Security Council Resolution 687, at the end of the war, that this system was established. Perhaps it is interesting to have a look at this resolution. It is, in fact, the document, the instrument at the basis of the entire system, where the Security Council states in its paragraph 16 of the resolution, reaffirms that Iraq is liable under international law for any direct loss, etc. Now, that is already something quite extraordinary. The Security Council is not a judicial body. The Security Council is a political body which declares a state liable. That should have been done by somebody like the International Court of Justice. Iraq was not given this opportunity. And then there was this entire mechanism, and we'll see some elements of this mechanism, that was then set up quite unilaterally. And that is one of the most extraordinary and, I would say, shocking aspects, that the entire process is a very unilateral process.
Mr. Schneider, you are saying shocking. Could you give me some examples of why you feel that this is not a fair process?
To start with, in any dispute resolution procedure in international law is based on consent. The resolution 687 was accepted by Iraq, but the resolution simply said that there was a mechanism to be set up. But then Iraq is not consulted in setting up this mechanism. It is not consulted in appointing the panel of commissioners who make reports on the claims. Iraq is not consulted on the final determination. It is a very unilateral process which really hasn't happened anywhere before to determine in international law the obligations, the liability of a state. That is already from the point of procedure. And then there are many other things. For instance, when the UNCC was established, the whole world was invited to make claims. It is quite extraordinary that the United Nations invite the rest of the world to make claims against Iraq. And if you imagine, in a war which was between Iraq and Kuwait, there are some 100 countries that are claiming against Iraq. So everybody who has any remote possibility of seeing that there is something they can link to the war makes claims. And that has come to the staggering amount, the total claims made in this body are over $300 billion. Over $300 billion are claimed against Iraq. Of course, not all of them are successful. And it's a bit less than half that have been adjudicated. And there have been awarded now $42 billion, a very high sum. And Iraq has paid a large amount of this sum. Out of every dollar that Iraq gains from oil sales through the Food for Oil program, it gets 25% go to the UNCC, where Iraq pays not only the claims, but the whole procedure, the whole administration, which is a large organization here in Geneva, the panelists, and everything.
Mr. Schneider, you were talking earlier about the damage to the environment in the whole area. Of course, the claims are made against Iraq and the Kuwait and Saudi Arabia are making those claims. Can you give us an idea about the environmental disaster that occurred in this area?
That is one of the issues which have now been started to be investigated. Now, there is a high degree of damage which occurred through the oil fires and the oil pollution of the Gulf. But what has to be seen is that the Gulf before was already a very highly polluted region. And one has to see the entire matter in the context. And indeed, it would be justified, in my personal view, and here I'm speaking really as an international lawyer, my personal view, to seize this problem of the environment, which is across border, to strengthen the regional cooperation in the field of the environment, rather than simply claiming high amounts of money. The issues of the environment are important issues which must be addressed, but unfortunately they are addressed in a very unilateral manner. Perhaps I can add in an example which is about to be decided on the question of liability. The Kuwait had claimed some $700 million for demining the country. Of course, there were minefields, but there was a large amount of what the specialists call unexploded ordnance, that is to say, bombs and shells in the country. But the biggest problem in all this were not Iraqi mines, but the biggest problem were the cluster bombs, which especially the Americans had dropped and which have had many unexploded elements. This was really the very dangerous part of the leftover of the war, but they were dropped by the Americans. And the Kuwaitis are claiming from Iraq that they pay, that Iraq pays for the clearing of these bombs.
Michael Schneider. Thanks to Samea Elibayari and Gretchen King at CKUT in Montreal for that story. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, protesters keep the heat on politicians and folk singer Dave Rovics and lots more.